Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is neuroscientist Dr. Douglas Fields. Dr. Fields is chief of the section of nervous system development and plasticity at the National Institutes of Child Health and Human Development, a part of the National Institutes of Health. He's an internationally recognized authority on the interaction between the two main cell types in our brain, neurons and glia, brain development, and cellular mechanisms of memory. He's recently written a book entitled The Other Brain, The Scientific and Medical Breakthroughs That Will Heal Our Brains and Revolutionize Our Health. To reach us with your questions and comments today about newer understanding of brain function and health and disease, you can call us locally at 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1, that's all spelled out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, line1 at kska.org. Dr. Fields, it's a real pleasure to have you joining us for the first time on Line 1.
Thank you.
I guess the hardest part of this interview, since we're not on TV or any interview almost, is talking to me and painting a picture for our listeners about the brain function, how it works, some basic anatomy. So we all can maybe start from this place of somewhat of an understanding about our brain, then we'll kind of work into some of the more complex, newer issues.
I see. Sure. All the nerves of the body enter into the spinal cord. Between the backbones, the vertebrae and the backbones, and they run up the spinal cord into the brain. And the brain is a multi-layered structure and also has many lobes. And the lower layers of the brain are involved in functions that are automatic, breathing and that sort of thing. And then the higher functions, thought and control of body movements, are in the cortex, we call the skin of the brain, the outer layer. But, you know, the interesting thing about it is if you just look at the brain, there's no clue as to how it might work. We've all seen pictures of the brain, and if you take a knife and cut it in half, you'll see that there are two kinds of tissue in the brain. And one is called gray matter, and one is called white matter. Now, the gray matter is this rind on the outside of the brain, and that's where all the nerve cells are. And beneath the layer of gray matter layer is what's called white matter, and these are nerve fibers that connect all the nerve cells together. And they're white because they're insulated with an electrical insulation called myelin. And we have 100 billion neurons in our brain, so you can imagine what this white matter looks like. It's millions and millions of cables. But that doesn't really give you any idea how it might work. It's, you know, 2.5 pounds of tissue that might as well be tofu, from the way, you know, there's nothing like a heart type structure where you could look at it and see, oh yeah, this chamber does this. And that's because, you know, the components of the brain are miniaturized and have to be seen with a microscope. So the brain really works on a cellular level. And if you look at brain tissue with a microscope, as early anatomists did around the turn of the century, you'll see nerve cells, which are dazzling cells. Probably need to have a little terminology here. This nerve cell has a wire-like output, which is an axon, and that's what sends the messages out. And at the other end of the cell, it has these root-like structures called dendrites, and those receive the messages. Now, neurons got all the excitement, and all of our ideas about how the brain works are based on something called the neuron doctrine. And that says that all information in the nervous system takes place by electrical communication passing through circuits of neurons that are connected together by synapses. And what we've just learned in the last few years is that fundamental assumption is incorrect. The interesting thing is that neurons comprise only 15% of the cells in the brain. And they're actually embedded in other cells, like raisins and dough or something. And these other cells were called glia, which means glue. And those are the cells that are changing our concept about how the brain works.
Thus, the title of your book, The Other Brain, which suggests that it's been there, but we were not recognizing the importance of these glia cells.
That's right. 85% of the brain has gone unexplored, and that's kind of an interesting question. How did we overlook half the brain? But, you know, this happens every time there's a revolution in science. And the reasons are, as neuroscientists, we were taught that the brain worked based on neurons. That's what we were taught and believed. And, the eyes see only what the mind comprehends, and so we didn't even see glia. And furthermore, since glia were thought to be nothing other than connective tissue, there's not much interest in studying them. If you're a neuroscientist and you want to know how learning and memory and all these things work, you're not much interested in studying connective tissue. So that means that the work doesn't get published in big journals and doesn't compete very well for limited funding for science. So there are these personal reasons, these perceptions, blind perceptions, and then also the organization of science, the way science actually works, that prevented us from this new insight into the brain. There's another reason I left out. We've been, and this is probably most important, we are using the wrong tools for the job now. Mm-hmm. We being neuroscientists, had studied how the brain works by studying the electrical signals in the brain. And to do that, we use microelectrodes, and we'd stick these electrodes into the brain cells or into brain tissue and use amplifiers and record the electrical activity. Glial cells don't communicate with electrical activity. So we could do that as we did for 150 years, and we would never understand what glia do. The breakthrough in understanding the other brain was the discovery that glial cells communicate, but they don't communicate using electricity. And the second thing that really changed people's thinking about the glia was discovery that not only do glia communicate, they can listen in to neurons, they can pick up electrical signals, perceive those electrical activity in neural circuits, communicate through glial networks without using electricity, but then go control the flow of transmission of information between neurons at synapses. So now we have a whole other dimension of brain function, which is completely outside the neuron doctrine. That's what's so exciting.
I want to take just a second, remind our listeners again, you're listening to Line One. My guest is Dr. Douglas Fields. Dr. Fields is a neuroscientist. He is not a clinician. We will be discussing some clinical issues, I think, during the program. But please keep that in mind if you have questions or comments. And you can reach us at 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address, lineone@kska.org. Dr. Fields, I'd like to focus a little bit longer on this neuroelectrical transmission and how it happens. Particularly, I want to bring up the concept of synapses and neurotransmitters, and then keep going back into this how glia then talk relative to that bit of information about how neurons are talking to each other, and then how glia might be involved in controlling the information that's passing along these electrical circuits. Do you mind doing that?
No, right. That's a good point. I mean, we can't understand the new findings till we all get on the same page about how neurons work. So neurons work by sending electrical signals over long wire-like fibers called axons. But neurons communicate with each other across synapses. And synapses are these points of close contact between two neurons. And I'm sure many of your listeners know that neurons communicate across this gap, not with electricity, but with neurotransmitters. So when the electrical impulse reaches the end of a nerve ending, it releases a neurotransmitter. That neurotransmitter binds to the next neuron in the circuit and stimulates that neuron. So there's this chemical communication. Now, there's one other aspect to this, and that's cleanup. When you release a neurotransmitter, it has to be removed so you can send another signal. And the cells that do that are glial cells, a certain kind of glial cell called an astrocyte. So the neuron will release the neurotransmitter, and the glial cells will take it up. But we've also found in recent years that glia can release neurotransmitters, and that was a big surprise. Mm. So now you have, if you think about it, all of the drugs that we use for treating psychiatric conditions, you know, SSRIs for depression, that those drugs just slow the take-up of neurotransmitter, and so that communication is stronger. But all the drugs we use for treating mental illnesses work by regulating neurotransmitters in the brain. All hallucinogenic drugs, from PCP to LSD, all work by affecting neurotransmitter levels. And suddenly you realize that glial cells are the cells in the brain that normally do that function.
And they're 85% of the cells.
They're 85% of the cells. And once new methods were developed that allowed us to realize that these glial cells are communicating without electricity, that was the real breakthrough into realizing that glia can be involved in controlling information processing as well as responding to disease and many other functions in the brain.
And just to stay with these axons just a little longer, is the way I found you is actually after reading a book by Dan Coyle called The Talent Code, in which he talked about the importance of, from his research and talking to individuals like yourself, that myelin was not also appreciated for its benefit of being increased with extra practice in using these neural circuits, and then also helping to coordinate, I believe, if I'm saying this right, the speed with which and the coordinating the timing of these impulses getting to interactions between neurons, which are very important in complex motor activities in particular. You mind maybe talking about that? And then do glia, are they involved in some of this as well?
Sure. Well, there are many different kinds of glia, just as there are many kinds of neurons, and they have different functions. There are glial cells that, instead of removing neurotransmitters at synapses, actually wrap electrical insulation around nerve fibers, axons. And if you look at it under electron microscope, it looks just like electrical tape that's been wrapped around a wire, up to 150 layers of this insulation that these glial cells put on the axons. Now, myelin is called myelin, and it fundamentally changes the way that impulses are conducted through nerve fibers, and it speeds the flow of the transmission of information at least 50 times. Now, many of your listeners know multiple sclerosis. People who have that disease is quite common. This is a disease that attacks these glial cells that make this insulation, and when that insulation is damaged, then you have disruption of communication, and you have dysfunction, blindness, and motor problems, and even some cognitive problems. But research in my lab had found that electrical activity could be sensed by these glial cells. And I can tell you how we discovered that. But we then found how these cells were sensing that activity. That led to the question of why would insulation be equipped by nature to sense impulse activity? And that led us to discover that electrical activity in the axon stimulates these cells to form more myelin. So that's my contribution to the story, all work done at the cellular level and the mechanisms. But this story also has another aspect from really clinical work and brain imaging, human brain imaging. Originally began looking at brains of people who have extraordinary abilities or disabilities, a dyslexia, for example, or on the other hand, looking at musicians, and trying to find if there are differences in the brain. And differences were found in brain structure with MRI. And the surprise was that these differences were found in the white matter regions of the brain that I described before, not in the neurons. So this led to eventual studies looking for changes in white matter after learning. Now, this is all very new research. For example, after you learn to read, there is a change in the brain, in the fibers, between parts of the brain that are important for visual recognition and reading. Same is true after learning to juggle. So I have to emphasize that in the past, learning was understood to be a strengthening of a connection or forming new connections. So neuroscientists like myself always studied synapses for learning. and completely ignored the white matter. But now that we see that there are these changes in the brain and white matter regions, in the connections, and then my work in culture showing that there are mechanisms for this, it led to the question, well, why fool with insulation on an axon? After all the information processing and memory had taken place in neurons, it didn't make any sense. Until you realize that to do anything that's complex, any complex cognitive function, a skill, like playing the guitar or catching a ball, that involves not just one little synapse getting stronger. That involves sending information over long distances from one part of your cerebral cortex to the other. You know, you catch a fly ball, you've got to have the part of the brain at the back of your head analyze that visual information, and then that has to communicate with the middle of your brain cortex to coordinate the motion of your legs. And then the frontal lobes of your brain have got to get engaged so that you have this game awareness to know, well, should I hold the ball or throw it to first? And you realize that to do any complicated function like that involves sending information long distances through the brain. And suddenly you realize, well, just like any kind of a train system or airline system, it matters how long it takes to go from one point to the other point. And there will be an optimal speed of information transmission through these different parts of the brain. And that's where myelin could be involved, because myelin can optimize the speed of transmission between these different points of the brain so that you become a better guitar player or a better baseball player. Now, the one caveat I need to make here is that the brain imaging done on people after learning shows changes in the regions, white matter regions of the brain, but it can't see cells, right? Mm-hmm. That's microscopic, and it cannot see myelin. All we know is this part of the brain has actually changed in structure. Mm-hmm. And, those people who were in those studies still have their brains. Mm-hmm. So we don't know right now in people if myelin has changed. Mm-hmm. We do know the white matter's changed, and it could be the myelin. It could be the diameter of the fibers. There could be other things that would change. Mm-hmm. So this idea is right at the forefront of science. And people are studying this now, and it's not going to be answered in human brain imaging. It's going to be answered in animal studies, where animals will be trained, and then we'll look at the brain after training to see if the myelin's changed.
So as I understand this, and this is where I want to make sure I understand it in listeners, is this repetitive doing something, learning to ride a bike early in life, stimulates neural circuits. Those neural circuits are in turn being, the use of those in a sense being sensed by glia, one of which helps make myelin appears increase in depth around those neurons, therefore making the transmission faster and more accurate. And that's one of the reasons we get better and better and better. And then one of the big premises of the talent code is what makes really, really good athletes really, really good is they start early and practice a lot. And that's the key. That's the talent code, part of the talent code secret there. And is that really oversimplifying it too much, or is that paint a good enough picture, do you think, to at least begin to understand what's going on here?
Although that's great. Those are all good questions. And, I think Dan Coyle did a great job. I think he's sort of a scientist, really, because what he did is he made an observation that there are these hot spots of talent around the world, and then he went out and interviewed, and he formed this hypothesis that, there has to be more than genetics. And not only that, he contacted me before any of my research was known to the public, so he's reading the scientific literature. But we have to separate what we know from what we hypothesize and think. Okay. We're going to discover based on these new findings, because, his book was about practical advice, and, it's not appropriate to get into the kind of things that I'm talking about, the cellular mechanisms in his book. Mm-hmm. So certainly those principles that he found are absolutely true, and there are several mechanisms for them, and this myelin white matter change is the newest mechanism. So, and glia can explain a lot of these. They can explain why you need to start young. That's something we call a critical period. But there are also aspects of repetition that involve changing synaptic strengths as well, which is something else I study in my lab. We study memory at a cellular level, and their repetition is very important as well. We can take a part of the brain of a rat and put it in a dish, stick in electrodes into the part of the brain that control memory, stimulate those neurons to fire, and then record the electrical response in the next neuron and see that it gets stronger. And learning is a strengthened connection or a new connection. So we study the mechanisms for that. How did that get stronger? And it's important to repeat the stimulus. So if we will stimulate those neurons several times, it will get stronger, but then it will fade, just like a short-term memory. But if you repeat it at 10-minute intervals, we found that this turns on genes that make proteins that cement those synapses together permanently. Hmm. Now, this makes good sense. You don't want to remember every experience you have. Remember the great parking spot we had in, mm-hmm. 1999 in Walmart. Who needs that? Mm-hmm. So the amazing ability of the brain is to decide what experiences to keep and what to forget. And the brain does that because memory is really about the future. It's not about the past. It's about preparing an animal so that if it ever encounters a situation again, it will have an advantage. So when things are repeated, then that sets up the molecular changes that strengthen synapses. So that's one reason repetition is important. And the reason this timing is important is because this is what we found in the lab is required to turn on these genes. So listeners can try this. I do this, and in fact, the whole school in England is based on this. It's called spaced training, where you will say what they have these kids, they give them a lesson, and then they have them go play basketball for 10 minutes, give them a lesson, same one over again, play basketball, a lesson again, and they find those kids are 2 years ahead of the normal kids. And that's because but repetition at the right rate is important. Mm-hmm. But then at the same time, we have repetition now being important in forming this insulation on myelin, and that is another aspect of learning that we can see in our lab, and that's the frontier of research now to find out whether or not that's really the case in learning in people.
This critical period is something I think I would like to expand on as well. It's my understanding, at least from the Talent Code and the little I know about this neurophysiology and neuroanatomy, is that most humans are not born with large amounts of myelin, but that myelination happens in a pretty definite sequence, but is continuing up through adolescence and then maybe things don't seem to keep going as fast with myelin as they did in the past. So one of the critical periods for learning is early childhood. Do you want to comment on this aspect?
Absolutely. That's very interesting. If we learn a language after puberty, second language, we're going to speak it with an accent. And there are critical periods for learning different things, and this is because the brain wires up and develops after we're born. So the human brain is unique from most animals in that it doesn't develop completely by birth. It develops up until about age 20. And so that was the first clue. If myelin is just insulation, why weren't the fibers insulated when you were born? That implies there was something else going on. And so what goes on in the human brain is that we cheat natural selection by evolving our brains, developing our brains in the environment that we're born into, so that your brain is different from my brain, and both our brains are different from cavemen brains. Other animals, otherwise it would be wired up according to genetics, it would be according to which cavemen survived, and it would be tuned for an environment we no longer have. So that's the secret to the success of our species, is that our brain wires up according to our early childhood experiences. And it turns out that myelin closes the period, the critical period. So different tracts, different parts of the brain will be changed and myelinate according to the experience. To give a specific example, Patricia Kuhl did a study of language development. And you know, all kids are born with the ability to understand any kind of sound in any language. You know, you can speak Japanese perfectly if you hear it as a kid. But she found that if you don't hear, if you're a Japanese-speaking person and you never hear English, you lose the circuitry in the brain that allows you to hear sounds that are in other languages. That makes sense. Why carry around in your head a circuit to hear a sound that, in a language you're never going to hear? So adult Japanese can't hear the difference between an R and an L sound. And we have the same thing. We can't hear differences in Chinese sound, chi and chi, you know. So to give you an idea, when we're born, the connections between our two brains, we have two brains, we've got 188 million at birth. But through experience, through childhood and into adolescence, we lose those connections. So we lose 70% of those connections. In the first few weeks of birth, we lose those connections at a rate of 50 a second. And then it slows down to a rate of 5 a second until adolescence. So there's this massive remodeling of the brain, massive rewiring of the brain according to what we're hearing and experiencing in our life, so that each of us has a brain that's ideally suited to the environment we're raised in until about adolescence, because our life changes in adolescence, and in evolutionary terms, evolution just wants to make an animal succeed to reproduction, and that's how genes get passed on. So this period of learning is very important up through about early 20s. And myelin continues from the back of the brain to the front of the brain. And it's not done until our early 20s in the frontal lobes. And the frontal lobes are the parts of the brain involved in higher-level judgments and cognitive functions. And this is why teenagers have difficulty with complex decisions. And we don't hold minors legally responsible because they don't have the circuitry in the brain to make these complex decisions. And it's myelin that is a large part of closing that critical period.
I think of that when I read some information on this. I think of it as by adolescence, they've just not had enough experience to understand the consequences of certain activities. And in a sense, in a learning situation, they don't have enough of that consequences to stimulate the right neural circuits and myelinization. And that's something that just comes with experience and time. Is, again, I know that's oversimplistically, but that
you're right. It's a good point, but I'd like to say in an evolutionary sense, or what's really going on here is evolution doesn't have any judgments. It's going to make your brain ideally suited to whatever you do with it. So if you're a couch potato, it'll be a great couch potato brain until you're 20, and by the time you're 20, that's the brain you'll have the rest of your life. So there's been studies done on musicians, and changes in the white matter are seen as these musicians practice, but the changes are only seen in the part of the brain that hasn't finished myelinating yet. And that's why we need to start young. Mm-hmm. So our brain will develop according to the environment that we're in. And the reason, you know, the message isn't to teach your kid music, is that as scientists, that's something we can easily study. But whatever we're doing is changing the brain. I'll give you another example. There's a recent study that just came out that did brain imaging on children and found that those that were subject to verbal abuse in middle school had less connections, less white matter in corpus callosum when they were adults. And they also had more psychological problems associated with as a consequence of that, more drug abuse and more depression and that kind of thing. So it's a very critical, this middle school years is a very critical period, because this is when this part of the brain is wiring up, and it's wiring up according to the environment you're in. So if you're in an environment where you don't hear a lot of language, or you hear abusive language, that affects the way that those parts of the brain get wired together. Or cannabis has recently been shown to affect the development of myelin, white matter. And so adolescents who are exposed to cannabis end up having an increased risk of schizophrenia.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the cannabis is not going to have the same effect on an adult because the brain has already myelinated. That part of the brain is already myelinated. So you can have these critical periods where the environment, be it a drug or bullying or learning to play the piano, is going to wire up the brain according to what you're experiencing. And once it's done, you know, it's fixed after you're 20.
This is really fascinating. I want to particularly come back to this interaction between the environment and brain development and how that comes about specifically. But we need to take a short break. I want to remind our listeners you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection in Anchorage. Our number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address, line1@kska.org. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll continue to talk with neuroscientist Dr. Doug Fields. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen again to Line 1, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking telephone calls. A copy of today's program will be available on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is neuroscientist Dr. Doug Fields. Dr. Fields practices at the National Institutes of Health. I should say he researches at the National Institutes of Health, and he's an internationally recognized authority on the interaction between the cells in the brain, brain development, and the cellular mechanisms of memory. He's also the author of a recent book explaining some of the newer developments and understanding of how the brain works called The Other Brain. If you've got questions or comments, email us at line1@kska.org. Remember to spell out line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, our local number 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And remember, if you're listening between 7 and 8 on kska.org, you're listening to a tape rebroadcast. We're only going to be here to answer your questions and emails for the next 30 minutes or so. We've got a couple of calls, but I want to get back to this real quickly, this gene or this interaction between environment and how it changes our brain, because this whole concept of interaction between the environment and turning on genes is really an exciting part of understanding cancer, immunology, chronic disease. And I really, until I'd read some of your book, didn't become to appreciate how much it's turning on genes, what we do every day, particularly when we're young, is turning on genes, which is causing these changes in how our brain actually develops, as you said. So how was this kind of discovered? Do you think this is an extremely important new understanding as well?
It is a new understanding and important, and this is the main focus of my interest, scientific interest. But if you just step back and say, you know, what is the function of this organ in our skull? It's to allow us to interact with the environment. And so our brain is modified according to the environment that we're in. And so this process, if you're going to change the structure of the brain, then that suggested to me, well, you're going to have to make new proteins and you're going to have to control the genes inside a cell. Now, every experience that we've ever had, you know, inside our head is nothing more than patterns of neural impulses. So I took neurons and put them in a culture dish with electrodes that allowed me to stimulate them. That means that, by hypothesis, if the environment can affect genes, then genes should be able to be turned on and turned off by stimulating them to fire in certain patterns. And so that's what I tested. So I took the neurons in culture. I had a stimulator. that allowed me to give different patterns, pulse patterns, to make them fire in different patterns. And I then did a gene analysis and found that I could turn on or turn off genes by just dialing up the frequency the same way you would do on a radio. And so it's quite exciting to see that, but it had to be that way. How else would you have, these cells growing and things? It's going to require the nucleus. But then that led to the question, well, how is that possible? And so we studied and found out how that works, that you can have a gene be turned on or off by making a neuron fire in different patterns. And what we didn't talk about is the new technology. And maybe I should just stop. If you don't stop me, Dr. Witter, I'll just keep going. So,
Let's hang on just a second. I think it's fascinating that we realize that things that happen in our environment, what we hear, what we do, what we feel, how we're listening to different languages, affects how our brain is actually changed. But we do have a couple of callers, and I would like to get into this in more depth, but perhaps we owe it to our listeners to take some of these questions. So let's take one right now. Bill, you're on line one.
Yeah, thanks. I'm having a hard time understanding. Is there an analogy you've come up with, the brain is an organ and it functions in a system? Is it like a garden where you have something above the soil that interacts photosynthetically electrically with the sun, and underneath the substrate in the rhizome there's things...
Barely.
Is it anything like that, or is there anything you can explain that makes it easier to understand?
Bill, we're having trouble hearing you real well. Can we get you to call back on a different line?
Sure, yeah.
Yep. All right, let's go ahead and we'll take the other caller. You're on line one. What can we do for you? Tobby?
Oh, that's me, I guess. Tabe.
Yeah, Tabe. Okay, what can we do for you?
If signals aren't transmitted by electrical impulses, how are they transmitted? Is it a chemical thing, or what actually carries the information?
Okay. Boy, you asked the question at just the right time, because that's what I stopped myself from explaining.
Okay.
So thank you for your question. As I was in my lab studying how stimulating these neurons made them fire, there was a new method developed in the late 80s and 90s that allowed us to see neurons firing with our eyes. Instead of using electrodes, we put dyes, like the dye in a glow stick, inside neurons. And, the electrical activity in a nerve cell is caused by charged ions going in and out of the cell. And so we just put this dye in that would glow when ions rushed into that cell, into the neurons. So we could actually sit there now with a microscope and watch neurons flashing and firing. We didn't need electrodes. So in my lab, other people had the same experience, but imagine the experience I had. You're sitting in a dark lab. I'm looking at these neurons in the dish, and I put the dye in there. I stimulate them with my electrodes. The neuron flashes. But then these other cells around the neuron started to flash. And I'd never looked at those cells before, and those cells were glia. So that's how we discovered that there's some communication that goes to these other cells. Now, to
is
be specific,
the signal then?
No. That's what allowed us to see that there was this communication. So at that point, all we knew is these glial cells were listening, and it involved ions getting into them somehow, in the same way neurons does. So that discovery then led to just your question: well, how are they communicating? And what we found out, we found out that glia have neurotransmitter receptors, the same ones that neurons have at synapses, that allows them to detect neurotransmitters. So that when a neuron fires and releases neurotransmitters, this also stimulated the glial cell. Okay? Then the glial cell responded to that neurotransmitter and, to everyone's surprise, released neurotransmitters. And it released the same neurotransmitters that neurons use, but also some special ones. These neurotransmitters then stimulated another glial cell. And so now you have communication, which is a chemical communication, by way of neurotransmitters being released from glial cells, releasing the neurotransmitter to stimulate the next one. And if you look and see this now, imagine what you'll see is the neuron fires, and now these other cells, glial cells, started to glow, release neurotransmitters, and now you saw a wave of color. And this was a wave of light that would pass through the whole tissue as these glial cells sent signals from one to the other. Very different from the way neurons communicate. They release neurotransmitters serially, like dominoes, one neuron in a chain to the next, glial cells are like cell phones, and they release the neurotransmitter broadly into the brain, and you have this wave of communication going through. And then the last bit of that is because these glia were communicating by sending neurotransmitters, they were able to then interact and affect neurons, because when they released neurotransmitters, that affected the neurons. That make sense?
Yeah, so very, very clever. Can I ask one more question?
You bet.
I'm getting a little bit long of tooth. What implications does this have for people who are aging?
Tremendous implications for aging. We've only talked about glia and learning and information processing, but glia are various kinds of glia, and they are the first responders in disease, trauma, injury, any kind of disease. Glia not only clean up after neurons in terms of neurotransmitters, they remove other things like the beta amyloid plaques in Alzheimer's. So glia are very, very much involved in aging. Now, as we age, the brain gets lighter. We lose about, after the age 50, we start to lose brain tissue. And by 65, we'll lose about 8% of the brain weight. A lot of that is neurons, but a lot of that is glial loss. The white matter begins to be lost. So that's one of the reasons for the cognitive decline. Glia are involved in many aspects of aging, and I should just let the questions come to me before I rattle them off.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for your call. Well, another listener is on the same line, and she's written an email and wants to know about exercise. There seems to be a lot of information coming down that suggests that exercise may stave off some of the effects of aging, it appears. What's your understanding of exercise and aging in the brain?
Well, you know, for a long time, the dogma was that neurons weren't born in the adult brain. And recently, in the last 20 years, 15 years, it's been discovered that the adult brain does give rise to new neurons. And this can be stimulated by various activities, including exercise. And now the mechanisms are worked out in quite good detail. We know that there are growth factors, which are proteins that stimulate the birth and the growth of neurons. These are released when you exercise. One of them is called BDNF. Doesn't matter. So it's true. There are new neurons born in the adult brain. The surprise is, or the significance with respect to the other brain, is that it's still true that neurons don't divide. So the neuron that you have when you're 80, you had when you were born, most likely, because an adult neuron can't divide. The new neurons are coming from immature glial cells. So the glial cells are also the source of these proteins that stimulate the birth of new neurons, and the glial cells themselves, in certain regions of the brain, can turn into neurons. Hmm. And in fact, this is being used now therapeutically. The first clinical trials to transplant cells into human beings for spinal cord injury is to transplant a kind of a glial cell called an NG2 cell. And now, this is a big deal. I mean, if you put somebody on a drug, and things don't go well, you just take them off the drug. But it took a lot of preparation before they did these experiments, because once you put these cells into a person, they're there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not going away. So the cells that they're using to treat spinal cord injury are a kind of glial cell called an NG2 cell. And in experimental animals, this has shown great promise.
And exercise is one of the factors that may stimulate these NG2-like cells to make new neurons?
That's been shown. Exercise does that.
Okay.
It's kind of a question. It's really philosophical. Why would exercise make new neurons? It's a fact. It's been replicated many times, and we've got it down to mechanisms. We know the molecules, but you know why?
Mm-hmm.
I read a paper recently that hypothesized that has to go back to the caveman days or our ancestors. That were really when did we enter into an arena where learning would be important? And this person argued that, well, there were two states. You were either hunting or resting. And if you're hunting, that was a cognitively challenging kind of a situation, and you would have to go out on the hunt and do navigation and capture the game, and so that involves a lot of physical exercise, and so that's one theory as to why exercise should have this effect on promoting birth of neurons and memory. I don't know if that's true or not, but it makes sense.
We have another caller, and I want to get to him, but while it's on my mind, I think this is important, at least to me. What is it that then, so we now we got an NG2 glia cell that's making these new neurons. What is it that drives the function of those newer neurons? How do they, what determines what function they're going to pick up? And why would they necessarily go to an area perhaps where neurons have been injured and left or died from natural senescence, whatever?
Well, yes, a lot of questions there. So part of it is these NG2 cells will form in response to injury or multiple sclerosis to repair damaged tissue, and they follow chemical signals in order to do that, and then they change into the kind of cells. These NG2 cells, by the way, make myelinating glia as well. They make other kinds of cells. But the basic thing that drives what we're talking about, and we call this neuroplasticity, is what we've been talking about this whole program, and that is functional activity of the brain. Mm-hmm. So the brain rewires. If you have an interesting example, this a neuroscience meeting I just attended, and brain imaging was done on people who are blind. And what they found is blind people can hear speech at amazing rates. All right, that announcer at the end of a commercial is going at 10 syllables a second. That's the limit of a sighted person. But blind people can hear 24 syllables a second. And I wish you could hear what it's on my website, but it just sounds like noise, pure noise. I couldn't tell what it was. And they found out that the way they were able to do this is their brain had rewired, because a huge part of the human brain is devoted to vision, and in blind people, it's all going to waste. So what happens is the visual cortex, the whole back of the brain, becomes rewired to the auditory part of the cortex, so that sound is now analyzed by this area of the brain that we normally use for vision. So it's function that drives the wiring of the brain and all of these things.
Okay. Just to remind our listeners, you're listening to Line 1. If you got questions or comments, our local number, 550-8433. Brian, you've been hanging on patiently. What can we do for you?
First of all, this is great stuff. You're doing a wonderful program. My question, he covered aging a little bit, but my question would be, what suggestions would you have for childhood learning that would be maybe a little different than how we do it right now?
Well, I think you have to provide the environment that you want this child to develop skills in. All right. So dyslexia is a learning disorder. It wasn't 200 years ago. Nobody could read. All right. So I think what you need to do is to provide the kind of environment and the stimulation, and it has to be done early in life, that will allow this brain to develop the capabilities that are going to make it successful in that environment. So I think, most of us as parents do this, but, you feel badly about children who are in situations where they don't have that, because they really have a difficult situation because of the critical period. And so if you have, children in orphanages or in isolation, that's going to have effects on the way their brain develops. So, I don't know.
Thank you.
All right. And we did get an email from someone asking specifically about dyslexia. I think this kind of line of thought gets people understanding that for a long, long time, at least in my practice of pediatrics, it's been well recognized that there is a very important time in child development that was very early. I guess it would be fair to say, did not understand the biochemical and structural correlates to that, and that's where the science has taken us to better understanding. So the email is, what's the relationship between repetition, that is increased development of myelin, and dyslexia? And I guess maybe in the other part of the question was, is there any new research addressing dyslexia that would that could be appreciated? Is there something that could be done early in a person's life with dyslexia that might circumvent, work around what appears to be some error in how the brain's functioning with words?
Sure. You know, I don't think of it as an error. Everybody's brain is different,
mm-hmm.
and that was the point I tried to make.
Okay.
You know, you and I are probably going to be, we're probably dyslexic on a computer because we weren't raised with it. I don't know how old you are, Dr. Woodard, but I feel that way.
Yeah, I'm older than you are.
Okay. So dyslexia, there was no reason to call dyslexia a disorder, I don't think. It's a disorder in our society, definitely, in terms of a disadvantage. Mm-hmm. But the part of the brain that we use for reading was actually designed to be able to recognize objects no matter how they're oriented. So that a cup facing to the right or turning to the handle on the left is a completely different object. And you have to think about how complicated it is to make a program that can tell you that's a cup no matter how you turn it, right? Try to imagine writing a computer program that could do that, because it's a different shape. But the part of the brain that does that is vital for our ability to operate in the real world. Turns out we use that same part of the brain in reading. So now if you can't rewire that so that a B is different from a D, then you have what's called dyslexia. So that's one thing I'd like to say. Secondly, dyslexics do get better. It takes a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And brain imaging shows that after reading, these connections in the white that can be seen with white matter imaging change after learning to read. So there's studies on dyslexia. There's also studies on adults who are being taught to read for the first time. And after learning to read, we can see these connections forming, white matter regions of the brain, forming between the parts of the brain that are necessary for reading. So this means that You can rewire the brain by practice, by learning to read, by function. So this plasticity, though, is most active early in life, where you still have those connections I talked about. You know, where if you're losing them at 5 a second through adolescence, and then once you're an adult, sure you can still learn, but you know, if I took up violin, I could learn to play it, but I'm not going to be in the symphony. If I took a violin and put it in the hands of a 17-year-old three years later, yeah, there's a good chance he'd be in the symphony, and that's the difference.
So, to be sure I understand that, then, in your mind, dyslexia is really a failure of stimulation of the right part of the brain at a critical period, and then can be changed later, but it's harder because that critical period is now being passed?
Well, I would say that you know, everyone's brain's wired a little differently,
okay,
according to two things: genetics, mm-hmm, and the environment.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can have developmental abnormalities,
okay,
in connections or,
okay,
where neurons,
right,
migrate.
Yeah.
But this can, to a certain extent, be, right, corrected by practice.
So that individuals may have some genetic abnormality. We might call it a single, mm-hmm, base that's abnormal, and so it makes it harder for them to learn. But if recognized early, then the appropriate treatment can overcome it more quickly and more easily.
That's right.
That right?
Just the same way a blind person can,
okay,
rewire their,
got
brain
you,
to hear sounds.
Got you. All right. We got another caller. I'm going to take Larry. You're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi. Thanks for the program. It's great. A question is, when in evolution did glial cells appear, and what did they evolve from?
Well, that's a great question. Glial cells are probably there first, we think, but myelin evolved with vertebrates, animals with backbones. And that's what's fascinating. You see the big difference between animals like slugs and worms and jellyfish, and the ability of an animal like a dog or a dolphin or people. The difference is in their myelinating glia. Animals with backbones have myelinating glia that speeds the impulse conduction, and invertebrates do not. And so what that means is that since we have this insulation, we can have tiny, tiny axons and compact more nerve cells into the same space, because of this myelin. And, you know, the way a neuron works in a fly's brain is the same as the way it works in your brain or my brain. What's different is myelin.
Are there glia in the fly's brain?
There are glia, and, you know, flies are great models for genetics, and a lot of people are now studying them to get at the questions you're asking and to see, you know, which glial cells in the flies correspond to what we see in humans, and then doing genetic studies to be able to understand functions of glia. But yes, the glia, flies have all the kinds of glia we have. They don't have the myelin kind that form myelin, though.
Wow. Very cool. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. We got about 2 minutes left just to remind you where we are. And one of the emailers implied that maybe I misunderstood the question about exercise in the brain, and she was not implying physical exercise, or maybe she also wanted me to include, what about brain exercise? What about what about these things that are being promoted so strongly now in preventing cognitive decline?
I wish we had more time to tell you, but yeah. There was a study done where the researcher put the rats in a running wheel, okay, made them exercise, found they learned better, found they got more neurons, higher BDNF and everything, okay, repeated all the other work. But instead of having the control animals sit in their cage, she took these animals out and put them in the treadmill but didn't let it turn. They also learned, okay?
Okay?
And so what happened, those control mice had an outing. That was intellectually stimulating to a mouse to be taken out of the cage and put in this new environment, and that stimulated the same thing as physical exercise. But I do have to say, there's a lot of hype about, you know, what you can do with aging. Sure, it's good, but there are limits. We all know that, and as you get older, a radiologist, a neurologist can see the age of your brain on an MRI just as easily as you or I can see the age of a person's face.
So just like exercise, I'm always a lumper, not a splitter in my thinking. It helps, but you're not going to put off the inevitable.
Exactly right. And the flip side of that is, you know, you can ruin things pretty easily. You know, smoking and all the, you know, drinking, all these other things we know are definitely, you can see this in your friends, you know, whatever, people who are really older than their age. So bad lifestyles are definitely to be avoided.
You want to give us a quick sum up of the important messages here in 30 seconds?
I guess the biggest thing is, the most exciting thing about writing The Other Brain is this idea that you have a revolution in science unfolding before your eyes. You know, it's like realizing the Earth is not the center of the universe, and we hear about this in the history of science, but this is happening right now, completely overturning fundamental ideas about how the brain works on a cellular level, and that's an interesting story to me.
If you want to read more about it, get Doug Field's new book, The Other Brain. Dr. Doug Fields, thanks very much.
Well, thank you very much.
Anchorage orthopedic surgeon Dr. Steve Tower will be with us next week, so why not join us January 24th at 2 p.m. for the next edition of Line 1, Your Health Connection. We'll discuss hip replacement surgery. Pat Yak is vice president of APTI News and Public Media. Kristen Spack engineered today's program and answered the phones for us. Thanks for listening, especially those of you who called and emailed. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available on our website at kska.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.